But if I may, I will briefly run through this. The trial occurred on 12/10/86 in the matter of Riley versus Ben Howard and Fincher Brothers. Mr. Riley was passenger in a car which was rear-ended by Mr. Howard, who was driving a gravel truck working for the Fincher Brothers. On 12/16, shortly after the trial had been going, Riley settled with the Finchers, and they were released from the case. Subsequently, a judgment was entered against Howard in the original tort action for $3.5 million plus dollars. Mr. Howard then filed suit against National County Mutual, alleging breach of Stowers, Arnold, and whatnot. Subsequent to that, Howard and National County Mutual went up on appeal. No supersedious bond was posted to cover the $3.5 million, although $25,000, which NCM contends is their policy limit, was paid into the district court at some point in time. Thereafter, in February, National County filed a plea in abatement as to Howard. Fincher Brothers intervened, Riley's intervened, and National County filed a plea in abatement as to Fincher. And 4/1/87, National County filed a plea in abatement motion to dismiss. Trial court denies that on April 13th and denies the National County's plea in abatement and the motion to dismiss as to the Rileys. The National County Mutual then files a petition for a writ of mandamus with the Second Court of Appeals. On 4/15/87, petition for writ of mandamus was filed. On 3/23/88, the Court of Appeals entered a judgment conditionally granting the writ of mandamus. Let me pause right there. The conditional grant was that Judge Street was to abate the Stowers case filed by Howard, but that discovery could go forward. Our position at this juncture, I as intervenor for the Rileys, we felt that because of that ruling, our discovery would be so limited in that case that we had to seek the relief which we are here talking about. The Court of Appeals, I've talked on that. On 4/1/88, we filed our motion for leave before this honorable court, and the petition for writ of mandamus with the Supreme Court 4/13. Now, since this has occurred, the Second court has entered its opinion in the principal case. That has occurred. The judgment in substance was retained by the Rileys, saving except for they took away $5,000 on a bystander issue, and they reduced her damages by 10%, that being the amount of negligence attributed to Mr. Riley. So, save and except for that, our judgment for $3,500,000 stands as it was granted by the trial court. Now, we believe, Your Honors, that this issue has effectively already been resolved by this court when you spoke in Scurlock. Justice Keltner, in taking a dissenting position in this case, points out that this court in Scurlock adopted the restatement of judgment section 13, comment F, which says the better view is that a judgment otherwise final remains so, despite the taking of an appeal, unless what is called an appeal actually consists of a trial de novo. Now, that's our position, simple. And as I see it, that's essentially the only thing before this court, is was Judge Street correct in allowing a discovery to go forward on the premise that the judgment was final. Please bear in mind, I have said no supersedious bond was placed with the court. The debtor, Howard, is at complete risk, and I, as the judgment creditor, can move on him and take whatever assets, notwithstanding that the case is on appeal. Therein in substance is our position. Therein in substance is what I believe is before your honors, is whether or not we have a final judgment which should allow us to then go forward and make discovery in the Sowers case against National County Mutual. We had given notice to take deposition of Mr. Howard, and we had also given notice to take deposition of some members of National County Mutual. I find that I have covered what I wish to cover. I did not think I would be long because there is not that much to say. It would be my pleasure to respond if anyone wishes to inquire. Otherwise, I will yield the floor to my opponent. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, counsel. Well, let me, before you do that, let me just ask one question regarding the propriety of the mandamus proceeding to overrule a district court in this particular instance when they file, when they make an action. That is appealable, is it not?
Yes, it would be appealable.
And they are proceeding an extraordinary remedy only to give you a relief when there is no other remedy. Doesn't that knock you off this particular relief?
Well, maybe I haven't heard you correctly, but I did not bring the original mandamus in the second court.
But this, you're bringing this mandamus here.
To set aside the Court of Appeals.
To set aside the Court of Appeals mandamus.
But there's an appeal then. There's an appeal from anybody who's injured or affected by the district court's decision as an appealable remedy.
I'm following you so far.
Therefore, if there's an appealable remedy, mandamus is not live.
Then they should have, that's what the second court should have said when the defendant, Howard, came to them and wanted to mandamus, but they did not.
You're saying it was an abuse of discretion for the court, for the second court, not to follow Abor versus Black.
Yes, sir.
And therefore we can mandamus the second court because they abused their discretion in granting the mandamus.
Precisely. I appreciate your putting it so succinctly.
Well, didn't we answer that question, though, in Johnson versus Fourth Court of Appeals? And we said rather than look at the Court of Appeals for abuse of discretion, we would bypass the Court of Appeals and look to the trial court to see if the trial court abused its discretion.
That's the way I understand. Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what he's arguing.
That's where I'm endeavoring to come from.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you so very much.
We are ready to hear argument from
Oh,
excuse me. I didn't realize.
Yes, I'm sorry. I apologize. I misspoke there.
May it please the court, my name is Clint Oldham. I'm speaking here on behalf of Fincher Brothers, who were a defendant in the case arising from the automobile collision and who are now an intervenor in the Stowers case brought by the plaintiff in the automobile, brought by the defendant in the automobile collision case against his own insurance company. Fincher Brothers is an additional insured under the policy of National County. Therefore, Fincher Brothers was owed the same duty that National County owed to its named insured in that policy. National County did provide Fincher Brothers with the defense in that case, provide them with a separate lawyer than they did on for the named insured, and provided for the defense in the tort case. During the trial of that tort case, it was decided by Fincher Brothers and their counsel that the prudent thing for them to do was to settle the claim against them before the case went to the jury. And they settled for a substantial sum of money and obtained a release some further liability and an obligation to pay according to the terms of the release, which of course was a written instrument. After the jury came back, I believe it indicates that the Finchers acted reasonably because the $3.5 million in damages found by the jury were substantially more than what they agreed to pay by way of the release. When the Stowers case was filed, wherein the allegations were made against National County for breach of their duties, fair representation, and claims of negligence brought by their primary insured, Fincher Brothers intervened in that case and asserted their own claims against National County for violation of the independent duties owed to Fincher Brothers as an additional insured by that insurance company. In the plea and abatement brought by National County, it is prominently displayed the no action clause of the insurance policy in question. And as I see it, that's the entire basis for the National County's claim in this case, which is to say that there is no final judgment because the judgment is on appeal. With no final judgment, therefore, there is no action against the insurance company until the duty of the insured is finally determined as indicated in the policy. Well, the policy says that no such action will lie until the insured's obligation to pay shall have been finally determined either by judgment against the insured after actual trial or by written agreement of the insured and the claimant and the company. It's our position here that that clause is met on its face with respect to Fincher Brothers. Not only has there been a trial, there has been an agreement in writing which does obligate the insured Fincher Brothers to pay money which they would not have had to have paid if National County had acted prudently and reasonably and diligently at the initial stages of the case and settled it. At least that's the allegation we make to be tried on the merits at a later date. I just want to point out to the courts that Fincher Brothers is not a party to the appeal that the insurance company claims is the basis for preventing the Stowers case. So it would be our position here, of course, that you should rule along the lines pointed out by Mr. Craig and settle the issues of finality of judgments for insurance purposes the way he indicated. But if you don't do that, there seems to be no basis for the Court of Appeals to have ordered Judge Street to abate the case as it pertains to the claims made by Fincher Brothers, a party whose obligation to pay has been finally determined as indicated in the policy. And therefore, we would ask the court at least to order the Court of Appeals to amend its order so that the abatement would not apply to the Fincher Brothers claims against National County because the finality issues have been met according to the terms of the contract on their face, separate and apart from whatever decision the court might make with regard to the ultimate finality of judgment rules for purposes of Stowers cases.
Had a supersedious bond been filed by the insurance company, would that entitle the second court to abate the action?
I'm happy to remark on the issue of supersedious bond because it seems to me that when you're dealing with an insured versus the insurance company, if they post a supersedious bond and protect the interest of the insured all the way through this process, they're acting much differently than if they do not pass such a bond or post such a bond and just hide behind or get behind the appeal and say that you can't take action against us, but you can take whatever action you want to against the insured. So I think it makes a real difference there. In terms of Fincher Brothers, however, I would say it would make no difference with regard to Fincher Brothers. We have a right to sue them. We have exercised that right. The fact that it was filed under Rule 60 in the form of an intervention really makes no difference at all. We're a plaintiff against National County.
Any questions?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Now we're ready for
response. Mr. Harvey L. Davis will present arguments for the Second Court Appeal.
May it please the court,
I am Harvey L. Davis, and I think that I will take a short time also. First, is it correct that the court has read the briefs submitted in this case before argument? The reason I ask that is because after my first point, I'm going to have to probably add a lot to this chart, because just as this chart fails to include the declaratory judgment action brought by National County Mutual that Mrs. Riley's claims for mental distress and loss of consortium were not covered by the policy, because the only bodily injuries that were suffered were by Mr. Riley. The chart doesn't mention that, and of course that is the most important and integral part of this case. But Mr. Craig says that Scurlock settles this case. I believe that the final judgment that must be entered in a Starwood decision has to be a final judgment or an agreement after all the appeals. This court has in effect held that in three different cases. And the most important of those cases is Hernandez versus Great American Insurance Company, in which this court changed the Starwood doctrine rule that you had to pay all or part of the judgment before the insured could sue the insurance company. They changed it in that case to a final judgment when the statute of limitations starts. Now, all of our statute of limitations use the term accrues. When a cause of action accrues, when it comes into being, when it comes into existence. And it doesn't come into existence against an insurance company until the final judgment is rendered. I'd like to read the important language from the Hernandez case. When we decide the time the cause of action accrues, we also decide the period of limitations. Any cause of action by one so situated, that is, situated, the insured in this case, Hernandez, arising in the future, will have limitations commence with the date of the final judgment against the insured. So I do not think that Scurlock affects this situation at all. The declaratory judgment action by National County Mutual seeks a final determination that will determine whether National County Mutual's conduct in this case was proper in paying its policy limits only for the bodily injury suffered by Mr. Rapp, and whether there was any coverage for Mrs. Riley's claims for mental anguish and loss of consortium. Those are the only issues that are in Ben Howard's lawsuit and the intervener's lawsuit that they're attempting to get tried. The Court of Appeals has, of course, the dominant jurisdiction to try those issues. And so does this court, when and if it gets to this court. Therefore, the cause of action that the Howards and the interveners have filed is premature. The Court of Appeals has a dominant jurisdiction to determine these issues. And in answer to one of the questions raised as whether this court should look to the trial court, whether there was a clear abuse of discretion, the answer in this case is yes, there's a clear abuse of discretion. Because in permitting this suit to go on, they're interfering with the determination of the Court of Appeals and probably this court.
Does that also apply equally against the Fincher brothers?
Yes, sir. I'll turn to the Fincher brothers situation. Mr. Olam said that National County Mutual provided Fincher with an attorney and paid his fees, and he participated in the trial. The reason for that was that the pleadings by Mr. Craig said that Ben Howard was an employee of Fincher Brothers, and therefore, under the pleadings, National County Mutual carried out its obligation to defend Fincher Brothers. But Fincher Brothers' position on the trial was very strong that Ben Howard was an independent contractor, and at the time of the accident, he was out on a frolic of his own. They took that position very vigorously. And Fincher Brothers, without notice to National County Mutual, without any agreement with National County Mutual, settled with the Riley's. That is a breach of the no action clause. They needed, under their obligations, if they were insureds, they needed to have the agreement of National County Mutual to settle. Fincher Brothers wants it both ways. They want to be independent contractors when it suits them, and now, when they see this $3.5 million judgment out there, they want to be the injured insurers. I believe that, unless there are any questions, that I've made my position very clear. I think the petition for writ of mandamus should be denied. I think the Court of Appeals has exercised its proper discretion and abated this lawsuit that never should have been instituted in the first place, until there is a final judgment.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I think I can be brief. The second court said the declaratory judgment sought by National County Mutual was for an advisory opinion. That is what the trial court said, and hence I think that disposed of the question about National County Mutual and their declaratory judgment. Is correct when he says that this matter may well appear down here because of the two issues that I think are paramount, and that is the jury in the trial court found that Ramona Riley experienced mental anguish which was sustained by her as a result of seeing her husband at the scene of the accident, because she was only about 3 blocks away. Someone who was at the accident scene went and got her, brought her back, and the record is fairly replete with a description of her reactions and what occurred there at the scene, and the jury found she sustained
her mental anguish there at the scene of the accident. And that's a different situation, I submit, from what has previously been passed on.
Mr. Craig, the court issued an opinion several days ago, the Freeman case out of Houston.
Yes, I'm familiar with that. The facts are just totally different, Your Honor. My time doesn't permit me to elaborate fully, but that was a case where the stepfather did not see the child at the scene of the accident, as I recall the matter. And here we've got a wife who saw the husband still pinned in the car, bleeding, and obviously a quadriplegic. Bit of a different story. This proposition of no action against the insurance company until an appeal is disposed of leaves the insured, not to mention the judgment creditor, in a rather unsatisfactory position. First of all, the insured continues to have judgment, interest accrue at 10% per day, compounded daily, on a $3.5 million judgment. Pray tell, what is he to do about that unless he can move forward and seek some relief in a salvage posture? His interests remain unprotected because no one has filed a supersedious bond, although I have repeatedly invited them to do so and would be delighted if they were to do so today. I don't think we would need to be here. The insurance carrier, under their contract, has the right to conduct the appeal. And by conducting that appeal, they have put the insured what I think is an untenable position, and I do not think they should be allowed to prevent that insured from moving forward in a Stowers-related case to protect his assets. Those are my remarks and my replies. Thank you so very much for your courtesy and attention this morning.
Thank you, Counsel.
Agreement. Entered into by the Rileys. In response to that, I just say that the attorney retained by the insurance company under Ranger v. Gwynn and other cases more recently decided than that is an agent and a sub-agent of the insurance company in his capacity as a representative of the insured. And if it's that attorney's advice and the client consents to enter into the agreement, that is, of course, a written agreement of the insured, comma, the claimant and the company as provided for in the policy. And that's all I have to say on that point.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral argument.